南无达萨帕格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨南无达萨帕格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨南无达萨帕格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨布达昂达曼萨康达玛萨弥On this occasion of January the 1st, the beginning of a new year, this is our opportunity to look back over the year that has gone by, to look at the present and to consider a direction for the future. One of the customs that we have in the Buddhist tradition, particularly in the southern Buddhist world, after having spent time together, often if you've been living at a monastery for a period of time, or you spent a rains retreat together, or the 3 months of a winter retreat together, or you're going off to travel to a different place, then there's a ceremony called asking for forgiveness. And this is a formalized way of recognizing that when we live together, when we live with each other, that there is a certain amount of friction. There's always an abrasion in the system, even with the best of intentions and people trying their hardest to get along with each other. Even if we don't know it, we annoy each other. We cause difficulty and frustration and irritation in the people that we live with. And the Buddha recognized this, and so right from the earliest times, he established this ceremony, this custom of asking for forgiveness. So it's a way of clearing the slate before you part company and go your separate ways. So I feel that for many people, the last year, particularly since March the 24th, if I remember correctly, the day the lockdown began, and there's been a lot of limitation, a kind of enforced retreat for many families. Certainly here at the monastery, there are very, very little travel been going on. And I've only been outside Amravati 3 times in the last year. Once to Hemel Hempstead, once to Berkhamsted, and once to the West Country. So that's much less traveling I've done in a year than in the entire rest of my life. Even ever since I was a tiny baby, I did more traveling than that. So it's been a year of limitation. So many, many people, those who are listening in, watching this in your own homes, will know that you've spent huge amounts of time with your own families in your flat, your home, your house. Living spaces of various kinds. And so there's that quality of enforced closeness and living in a situation where you're nearer to your near and dear ones than usual. And so it's natural to have for there to have been friction and difficulty, that there have been times where you've, got upset or angry, frustrated, irritated with each other. Certainly that happens within the monastery as easily as it does in other places. And so this beginning of the year, often on this day, this is the quietest January the 1st that I've ever known at Amravati. Usually we have 300 or 400 people coming in from the earlier part of the morning and through the day, arriving midday and in the afternoon, and many, many people coming to ask for blessings or to have a blessing cord, a piece of string tied around their wrist, as a way of beginning the year in the most auspicious way possible. And so we can't really do any sort of long-distance string tying. That's not really... maybe in 10 years' time they'll have invented ways of like having sort of automatic 3D printing of objects in your own home via a webcast, but they haven't invented that yet. Holograms are still a bit of a novelty as well. But we don't really need the string in order to be, conveying the blessings and making good use of this occasion. So what I would suggest in the beginning of this Dhamma talk, what I thought would be skillful, is say later on today, I would suggest there's nothing obligatory. I'm not sort of requiring or demanding of anybody, not at all. But I might suggest that within your own families, in your own homes, to take the opportunity to ask forgiveness of each other. So between parents and children, children and parents, between wife and husband, partners, the younger and the older, sibling to sibling, sister and brother to sister and brother, and all the members of the family in various ways, to carry out this kind of ceremony as a way of clearing the slate and to begin this new year afresh, to have a fresh beginning. And this is you can carry it out in your own ways, I would suggest. But some form of coming together and then finding some string. I imagine that most homes have got string of some kind. Ideally, it's undyed cotton thread, but it can be whatever kind of threads you can find. And you cut a length about a foot long, or a little bit less, and then tie it, and one of you will tie it around the wrist of the other, and then when you've tied that on the other person, you say, by whatever I have done, by body, speech, or mind, that has been irritating or upsetting to you, I ask for your forgiveness. And then the other person takes a similar piece of string, ties it on the second person's wrist, and they say also, I too, whatever I have done, my body, speech, or mind that has been upsetting or irritating or annoying to you, I ask for your forgiveness. And then to simply bow to each other. And this is, I feel, it's just a made-up ceremony in a way, but I feel it's a skillful and useful adaptation of this traditional form as a way of recognizing that even with the highest of ideals and the best of intentions, that we get lost in our moods, we are harsh to each other, we are dishonest or unkind, and can behave in hurtful ways. But we don't want to be that way. That goes against our highest ideals, our best of intentions. And so this is, I feel, a skillful way. I would suggest nothing, again, there's no demand or nothing obligatory, but, and you can make up your own version of this, but a way of acknowledging that and say asking for forgiveness, and to see the effects of that when you make yourself open in that way, and you recognize that if I didn't realize I was being upsetting, I could have been really upsetting. Because sometimes the things that we do, even the way that we talk or walk, the way that we're always so helpful, it can be really irritating to other people. Why are you so kind? It's so annoying. Even our efforts to be kind and generous can be irritating to other people. I speak from experience on that. So whatever might have happened, whether we're aware of it or not, to say, please forgive me for anything that I've done that has been upsetting. And in that way, one is at least making the gestures of recognizing the difficulties of living together, also acknowledging our highest aspirations to live in ways that are skillful and beneficial, that are say, mutually supportive, and then to establish that as a good way to begin the year. And so this is, say, my opening suggestion. In the absence of being able to come here and to Amravati and have a string tied on here, to tie strings on each other, and to use this asking for forgiveness and offering forgiveness as a sort of do it in your own homes kind of a substitute. Well, part of the purpose of coming together, coming to a monastery on the first day of the year, is to, say, establish one's skillful intentions as a sort of a Buddhist version of making New Year's resolutions. You want to begin the year in the most auspicious way possible. And so coming to the monastery, offering dana, making offerings to support the monastic community is a traditional and, I would say, very, very skillful way of establishing those intentions. And And also to reaffirm the Buddhist training, the Buddhist practice as a central feature, the guiding spirit of one's life, and built around dana, our generosity, and then sila, the virtue, the quality of virtue and morality, and then bhavana, meditation. And so the coming to the monastery is a way of supporting all of these different aspects. And in this respect, there's a particular teaching that I like to refer to that in a way encompasses all of those different dimensions of dana, sila, and bhavana, of generosity, virtue, and of meditation. And to me, it's also a very powerful reflection in the Dhamma teachings on how the Buddha saw the various, degrees of benefit that come from those aspects of the threefold training, that threefold dimensions of the practice. And it's called, this particular teaching is called the Velama Sutta. It's in the Book of the Nines in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. I think it's Sutta number 20, if I remember correctly. Anyway, it's called the Velama Sutta. And the Buddha is using the example of a previous life as a bodhisattva, when he was a Brahmin called Velama. And in that lifetime, he made this. He was extremely wealthy and had made this enormous offering. This kind of huge, huge offering: 84,000 gold pots filled with silver, 84,000 silver pots filled with gold, and thousands of elephants and horses and all kinds of riches. And as an offering that was made. And then he describes how, even though that was an enormously abundant and generous offering, that it would have been a more valuable, or the benefits that came from that offering would have been greater if they had been made to someone who had realized the level of stream entry, or had those kind of spiritual accomplishments. Then he goes through sort of grade by grade, saying if it was to a stream enterer, to a once returner, to a non-returner, to an arahant, or to a group of 100 arahants, it would have been, you know, the blessings, the benefit would have been greater. And all the way up to saying, but even more beneficial than that would be to be offering to a sangha led by a fully enlightened Buddha. That would be extremely meritorious. That would be incredibly beneficial. So all of that kind of that area is what we call amisa dana, amisa dana, or material offerings. And at the end of that, he says, but even more meritorious than giving that kind of an abundant offering to a sangha led by a fully enlightened Buddha, to offer a dwelling to the sangha, to offer a kuti to the sangha, is even more meritorious. Then he goes on to say, from the material offerings, he then says, but even more meritorious than that is to take refuge in the triple gem, commit one's heart to and sincerely take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So, and to me, that's a very impressive teaching. So that you might think, oh, that taking the refuges, that's just a little part of what we do when we go to the temple. And the more important thing, I'm not trying to discourage people from bringing food to the monastery. We all get hungry. We're all grateful for the food and other material, the amisa dana that comes in. We're all very grateful to and appreciative of the efforts that everyone has made over this last very difficult year to keep coming to the back gate and providing nutrition for all of us. It's been kind of amazing how that faith and commitment has been sustained by so many of you, and we really appreciate that. But it is striking to me that the Buddha says that to take refuge in the triple gem is more meritorious, there's more blessing that comes from that than in making this massively abundant offering, which nowadays would be like billions and billions of pounds worth of offerings, that would be of a huge, colossal nature. More meritorious is to sincerely and genuinely take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Then he goes on to say, but even more meritorious than that is to take the five precepts, to determine the five precepts that we just did at the beginning of this ceremony as well. We started with the three refuges and then the five precepts. So it's even more meritorious than taking refuge in the triple gem is to determine the five precepts and to live according to those principles. And then he goes on to say, then goes more into the dimension of bhavana or meditation. He then says, even more meritorious, more beneficial than that keeping of the five precepts is to practice loving kindness for the time that it takes to milk a cow. So most of us didn't grow up on farms milking cows and not very aware of that, but my understanding is it takes about 15 or 20 minutes to milk a cow, as it did in the Buddha's time, still does today. So to practice loving kindness for 15 or 20 minutes, that's even more meritorious. And then the final part of that sequence, the very end of it, he says, but even more meritorious than that, even more beneficial, what brings the greatest blessings of all, is to sustain the insight into anicca, into uncertainty, impermanence, for a finger snap. It's even more meritorious. And all those kinds of material offerings, making a kind of massively abundant offering to a sangha with a fully enlightened Buddha at the head of it, and taking of the refuges, the precepts, and so forth. More meritorious than any of that is to genuinely see the nature of reality, to see the truth of anicca, to know that directly, just for a finger snap. So that is, in a way, he's pointing to the culmination or the fulfillment of the practice of meditation. And so the establishment of wisdom, the establishment of clear seeing. So I feel that that's a really wonderful teaching and one to bear in mind. And in that you see the Buddha brings those three qualities together, dana, sila, and bhavana. And then points to the value of them. And even though one doesn't want to dwell too much in comparison or sort of measuring things up in precise detail, I do feel it's helpful to bear those kind of things in mind, because we can think that dana or the supporting the monastery or creating good karma in our life is built around material offerings. And again, I'm not dismissing that or criticizing that in any way. It is a very important, significant foundation. But in that teaching, he's pointing to that, yes, that is a powerful source of goodness and good karma in our lives. But the qualities of virtue and the beneficial effects of meditation, they go deeper. They have more powerful effects. They are more, profound and powerful sources of happiness and sources of genuine freedom and fulfillment in our lives. So another way of looking at that same collection of qualities is that they're also, you can consider them as the different kinds of dana. In a way, they're all kinds of generosity. And that when the Buddha spoke about dana, he didn't just mean amisa dana or the material offerings, but also he spoke about the precept, keeping the precepts, is also a kind of dana. And this is another teaching I like to emphasize that sometimes people miss out, because when we think of keeping the precepts, the five precepts, or the eight precepts, the 10 precepts, or the 227 precepts of the monks, or the 150 some odd precepts. 150, is it? For the Sila Dharma? Ish. about 150 precepts for the Sila Dharma, that we think of that as a set of limitations. You can't do this, can't do that, can't eat in the evening, can't touch money for the monastics, for lay people. You can't kill things, you can't steal things, you can't engage in sexual misconduct, you can't tell lies, you can't use alcohol or drugs, and so on. So it can come across as a set of boundaries or limitations. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. And so it can be perceived in that kind of a way, have that kind of a tone in our lives. But I feel it's very helpful and significant to see how the Buddha also spoke about the five precepts as the five great gifts, the Mahadana, he called them. And he said, if you keep the first precept of not killing any living beings, then you give to other living beings around you incalculable, immeasurable freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, freedom from distress, because they don't need to worry about you. They don't need to be afraid of your presence. You're not going to kill them. You're not going to hurt them. So they don't need to be afraid of you. So you are giving fearlessness. It's called abhayadana, the giving of fearlessness. And then he goes on to say, and in turn, by refraining from killing living beings, you give freedom from fear, freedom from distress and anxiety to those beings. And in turn, you give yourself freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, freedom from distress. Similarly with the other five precepts, the refraining from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from lying, and from the use of intoxicants. So I feel this is a different way to look at the precepts. It's that they are a gift. They are an offering that we can make to the people around us, to the world around us, and that again, when the Buddha was speaking about different kinds of dana, that he said that quality of abhayadana is superior to the amisadana, that the beneficial effects for our own spiritual life, our own happiness, our own freedom, our own well-being, those gifts are greater. The benefits are greater. They're stronger. And I feel it's helpful at this time, the beginning of the year, when we're sort of setting a direction for ourselves the time of reconsidering, okay, where have I got lost, what's been difficult, what's been beneficial, to really bring this to mind, so that when we determine the five precepts, to not just think of it as a set of don't do this, don't do that, and a set of limitations, but rather it's a means of giving. That it's and not as though we're kind of inflating our egos, assuming that we're the sort of we're a great gift to the people around us in an inflated or egotistical way, but rather to see that how lovely it is, how beautiful it is when people can trust you. They know that when you talk with them, you engage with them, you're not going to lie to them, you're not going to deceive them, you're not trying to get anything from them, you're not going to cheat them or rob them, so that your relationship with other people is very easy. It's very very comfortable, very natural. And also, as in that, the way the Buddha expressed it, if you, by granting fearlessness to others, you grant fearlessness to yourself. So, and I think most people have probably seen this, where many of us will have recognized in our own lives that if you go around criticizing, complaining, and speaking badly about other people, then you tend to think that they're criticizing, complaining, and speaking badly about you. But you create the causes for feeling that you're being treated in that way. If you lie to others, then you tend to assume or think that people are lying to you. And again, this isn't universally true or always the case. But if we look at our lives and explore how that works, I feel it's very significant. You know, if you're making fun of people, you're criticizing or finding fault with others, or laughing at other people, teasing other people, and putting them down for the way they look, or their where they live, or how they dress, or their mannerisms, then what happens is that you then feel that people are criticizing you or making fun of you or putting you down. That's how karma works, karma and vipaka, the action and its results. And similarly, if you don't criticize other people, you don't make fun of them, or you don't deceive them, or want to take advantage of them, then you find that ease in your heart. You're not you're not creating that cause for others to be seen as a danger or someone who's trying to hurt you or take advantage of you or deceive you or mistreat you. And so that I think a very valuable principle to reflect upon, to see how that works. And then when we reflect upon the effects of dana, of generosity, yeah, look at that to see that the effects of living virtuously. The Buddha said, if you practice the sila, you don't have to think, may I be free from remorse, because it's completely natural. if you live according to the moral precepts, there won't be any criticism for your own actions and your own speech, that because you haven't created the causes for that. And then that in turn becomes a cause for a relaxation in the body, that the one who is free from remorse doesn't have to think, may I be at ease, may my body and mind be relaxed, because in that particular teaching he says how, yeah, it's natural, it's in accordance with nature that one who is free from remorse is relaxed in body and mind. They experience a quality of ease and delight, pamoja, a sense of inner delight, inner joy, and inner comfort. In Western psychology, we might call that self-respect. But basically, being comfortable in your own skin, you're at ease with how things are. And then in that teaching, it goes on to say how if there is that kind of physical relaxation, that inner contentment, then that becomes a natural basis for samadhi, because that quality of ease, relaxation, contentment, you don't have to think, as he says, one whose body and mind is relaxed, who is at ease, and who is content, they don't have to think, may my mind be concentrated, because it's natural, it's in accordance with nature, that one who is relaxed and at ease, the one who is experiences that quality of contentment, it's natural, it's easy for them to concentrate the mind. So that's a direct cause for samadhi. And then goes on to say, one whose mind is easily concentrated, they don't need to think, may I realize knowledge and vision of the way things are, because it's natural, it's in accordance with nature, that one whose mind is concentrated will see experience knowledge and vision of the way things are, and one who experiences knowledge and vision of the way things are doesn't have to think, may I let go, may I free the heart from grasping and develop dispassion and detachment, because one who sees the way things are naturally is dispassionate and detached. And then for one who is experiencing dispassion and detachment, there's no need for them to think, may I realize knowledge and vision of the way things are, may I realize the knowledge and freedom, liberation, because one who is dispassionate and detached, who's let go, then it's natural for the quality of liberation and full knowledge and liberation to arise. So right at the very root of that is virtue, sila. So that it's a direct cause, and that kind of a causal sequence that the Buddha describes. It's a natural process. And that teaching is known as liberation is a natural process, that you can find in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses. Also, that last part of the Velama Sutta, where the Buddha says, to sustain insight into the impermanence of things, the uncertainty of things, that is just for the length of a finger snap, that's the most virtuous of all. You know, brings to mind the Lumpo Cha's teaching about anicca and the development of the perception of anicca. And in a way, that's in the different kinds of dana, generosity that the Buddha speaks of. He says amisa dana, material offerings; abhaya dana, the offering of fearlessness; and the third type is dhamma dana, the giving of dhamma. And so I feel that that when the mind is awake, to the way things are, then in that moment, it's the mind is most fully and completely embodying Dhamma itself. Lumpur Chao made in one of his Dhamma talks, he makes this rather unusual comment. He says, "Uncertainty is the Buddha," which is a bit of an attention grabbing comment. Uncertainty is the Buddha. Yeah, how does that work? Uncertainty is the Buddha, and then he sort of drops that into the group mind and says, "And how does that work?" The uncertainty is the Buddha because uncertainty is the truth of nature. One who sees Dhamma sees the truth of uncertainty. That is the embodiment of Dhamma in our experience, is the truth of uncertainty. The Buddha said, "One who sees the Dhamma sees me. One who sees me sees the Dhamma." So if the Dhamma is the truth of uncertainty and the Buddha is the Dhamma, therefore, put that together logically, then the Buddha is uncertainty. Sorry if that's confusing, but I feel it's a helpful reflection in its own way. So that when the mind really knows the truth of uncertainty and knows that things are in a incessant state of change, and that's not just an idea like, "Oh, I'm remembering the sentence, everything is uncertain," but it's really the mode of vision, the way of seeing, the way of knowing, recognizes that quality of uncertainty, of change, then at that moment the heart is embodying the Dhamma itself. And the awareness that arises from the Dhamma is the Buddha mind. When we say we're taking refuge in the Buddha, it means being awake, being aware. Taking refuge in Dhamma is taking refuge in reality, in nature, being in accord with the way nature is. Refuge in Sangha is the actions that arise from that awake, aware quality, knowing the way things are. When the Buddha sees the Dhamma, what arises is the Sangha. So when the awake mind sees the way things are, then what arises is virtuous action. So when the mind is awake to the quality of uncertainty and change, right there is the mind is embodying Dhamma. It's being Dhamma. And it's not anything other than the obscurations of ignorance falling away, of greed, hatred, and delusion, those usual familiar ways that natural quality of the heart is obscured or distorted and clouded. When those obscurations, delusions fall away, then the natural awake, aware quality of the heart is able to know the way things are. It's really, as I like to put it, Dhamma aware of its own nature. So that the Dhamma Dana, the giving of Dhamma, sometimes we relate to that as meaning or printing Dhamma books, which again, I'm not criticizing that. I'm very, very happy for people to sponsor the printing of Dhamma books. I've written enough myself. So, but people think, "Oh, Dhamma Dana equals printing books with words of Dhamma in them and giving them away or sponsoring the printing of books." Well, that's one aspect of Dhamma Dana. But really, I think in its essence, that embodiment of Dhamma, so that, as Lumpur Cha would say it after, in the process of the practice, after listening to Dhamma, understanding Dhamma, practicing Dhamma, realizing Dhamma, the last part of that is being Dhamma. And that the more fully and completely the heart is awake and knows that quality of change, the more it is embodying Dhamma, it is being Dhamma, and is fully in accord with reality, with nature. And with that comes a quality of spaciousness, peacefulness, contentment, and a comprehensive ease, what we mean by Nibbana, that coolness of heart. So here on January the 1st, and it's in a sense to boil all that down, to summarize all of that in terms of, sort of New Year resolutions or setting a direction. As I, in the Dhamma talk yesterday evening, I was reflecting on these themes also this morning, those of you who are were listening in, watching in this morning, that I feel we can boil these principles down to two simple qualities. And this is, again, qualities that Lumpu Cha would emphasize over and over and over again. And this is on the internal side, on the inner side, establishing right view. So when we take refuge in Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha, that's setting an attitude. It's like establishing that attitude, a way of seeing things, so the way that the heart frames the world, the kind of the what we place at the center and make the priorities or the centerpiece of our lives, that also establishing right view, seeing in terms of Dhamma, seeing things in that framework. So establishing right view internally, and then externally manifests as virtuous conduct, keeping the precepts. So on the beginning of the year, in terms of establishing intentions to say taking the triple gem as the basis for our life, establishing a skillful attitude, establishing a view of the world, a view of our life, our mind, and the world around us, establishing that view based on Dhamma, right view, we would call it, the samadhiti. And then that manifest, that view being established, then that, informing the way we speak, the way we act, the way we interrelate with the people and the world around us. So that those two qualities, right view and sila, those of you who've listened to Lumpu Cha's Dhamma talks or read his teachings, you know, over and over and over again, these are the two central qualities that he emphasizes, virtue in terms of action and speech, and right view in terms of one's inner process. And we can establish that as an intention, and any of us who've ever tried to make New Year's resolutions in the past know that they can sometimes have an extremely short half-life. That January the 1st, yes, this is definitely what I'm going to do. Okay, no more drinking. That's it. Finished. Yeah. It's my last cigarette. You know, I'm going to do an exercise routine. I'm never going to argue with my partners, my fellow monastics, or and we set an intention. We set a New Year's resolution, but sometimes they can fade away. They can erode very, very quickly, and they have a short half life, as they say. And so it's useful to consider to the degree that we can, how do we most effectively sustain those resolutions? How do we help them to be fulfilled? How do we carry them out? And one of another of the teachings I find that's really important, helpful in this regard, is when we were chanting the Paritta, we chanted the Mangala Sutta, and the first line of the Mangala Sutta, the highest blessings, Asevana chabala nang panditana chasevana, not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise. This is the highest blessing. So the Buddha made it very clear. It makes a difference who you spend your time with, and obviously if you're in lockdown, and you can't travel or you can't go to work or you can't go to school, then the range of people that we can choose to spend time with is limited. I appreciate that, but that being the case, still I feel this is an important principle to bear in mind, and so that the Buddha pointed to the friends that we have, people who we associate with, because even if we're sort of physically close to one set of people, We are, most of us are in communication with others, and we also have a choice of what we attend to in the media, or what we look at on the TV or the computer, or who we connect with via chat groups or WhatsApp or Facebook or whatever. There's a lot of different ways of associating. It's not just who's in the same building with you, but we have a dispersed identity, as they call it nowadays. We can, you've got a Facebook address, a WhatsApp address, an email address, a blog posting address. We are kind of, at least etherically or digitally, in many different places. And so that we connect with a lot of other people and a lot of situations. So I feel it's skillful to consider this this principle. Who do we spend our time with? What do we talk about? What are we gathering around? What are the kind of focuses of our attention? And a similar teaching to the Asevanacha Balanang, not to associate with fools, to associate with the wise, is the Buddha's teaching about Kalyanamitta, when Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, I think that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life. The Buddha said, no, Ananda, not so. It's not half the holy life. It's the whole of the holy life. And that's not a small statement. That's not something insignificant. That the Buddha expands that in that teaching, but again, it's underscoring who do we choose to spend our time with? Yeah. Where do we make our friendships? And we do have choices. And often when I emphasize this, and I talked about also in another teaching where the Buddha emphasizes that one of the, or the main root for diminishing ignorance and strengthening the spiritual qualities is sapurisa sangseva, association with good people. Then I've would emphasize that in a Dhamma talk like this. Then at the end of the talk, a few hands would go up and say, "But Ajahn, you don't know my family," or like, "Would you like to have words with my boss?" You know, I'd really like not to associate with difficult people, but that's how my workplace is, or that's how it is in my family. So again, I appreciate that, but. I do feel it's something that we do have choice in. Who do we get together with? Who do we strengthen our connections with? And if we see that a connection or an association that we have is something that's harmful or obstructive or creates more confusion and difficulty, then to see how we can incline away from that. And to disconnect from things that are harmful, and to connect and to strengthen the friendships, the bonds that really are beneficial, and also to consider when you are together with your friends or people that you have a close affinity with, or you feel very supported by, and that they really understand you. What do you do together? What do you talk about? What do you focus on? What do you encourage in each other? And I think these are, in terms of sustaining our resolutions, if we want to try and embody Dhamma and be and to say use our life for the greatest benefit possible, then these are important things to reflect on. Where do we put our attention? Who do we spend our time with? And where do we have choices? How much are we a victim of circumstance, and how much do we say have a degree of control, a degree of autonomy in where we go, who we're with, and what we do? And I speak from my own life. I found I was almost always just carried along by the force of circumstance. The people I happened to be with, I would just, whatever they were doing, I would do it too. I would join it. Whatever they were talking about, I would talk about it too. So I tend to have a bit of a spongy personality, very easily influenced by the people around me. I think it's one of the main causes I was drawn to join the Sangha at the age of 21, because I could see the destructive effects of just being sort of swept along by circumstance. But I do feel it's important to take a step back and consider, well, do I really have to do this? Do I really have to spend my time with these people? Do I really have to join in with this just because of some sense of, I should, or I must, or I can't not be involved to step back and say, well, is that true? Who says? You know, can I make a choice here? Well, why am I doing this? Why am I interested in this? Why am I putting time and energy into this? And to let that be really considered. Maybe the last teaching to share with you all on this New Year's Day is that particular teaching about the importance of Sapurisa. So Sapurisa, Purisa means a person, Sat means good or true. Sangseva is to associate with. So Sapurisa Sangseva. The Buddha outlined this as the first of the qualities that is supportive of stream entry. And in one of the rare places where he talks about the basis or the origins of ignorance, of avijja, not associating with good people is right at the root of that. So if you don't associate with good people, then you don't create opportunities to listen to the good Dhamma, Sadhamma Savana. If you don't listen to the Dhamma, if you don't put your attention onto skillful and beneficial teachings, then faith doesn't arise. Without faith, then the mind isn't inclined towards wise reflection. You just sort of follow your thoughts and like I was saying, you're kind of pulled along by the current of circumstance and living in an automatic way. So without wise reflection, then there's much less sati sampajanya. There's the quality of mindfulness and awareness or intuitive wisdom that's reduced. Without much in the way of mindfulness and full awareness, if sati sampajanya is reduced or not supported, then we tend to be more reactive. We are unrestrained in our actions and our speech. We are reactive rather than responsive. If we live in a reactive and sort of conditioned, automatic way, then that tends to feed what are called the three unwholesome courses of action: unwholesome speech, unwholesome action, unwholesome thought. And then that feeds the five hindrances: sense desire, ill will, dullness, restlessness, and doubt. And the five hindrances are the fuel. that's what provides the fuel for avijja. That's how avijja, ignorance, is supported. But this is a teaching in the Book of the Tens in the Numerical Discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, Sutta 61 in the Book of the Tens. And this is one I feel is very, very well worth getting to know. Then he says that's how that causal chain works. He says that's just like rain falling onto the mountains. If the rain falls down on the mountaintop and then forms into little pools, the pools form into small streams. The small streams join together into bigger streams. The bigger streams form into rivers. The rivers flow to the sea, and that's how the ocean is filled up. So that's how ignorance, avijja, is filled up by those causes. But the opposite then is whereby if we draw close to good people, we choose to spend time with Sapurisa, good people, good friends, Kalyanamita, then that increases the opportunity to listen to the Dhamma, to use spiritual teachings, to put the attention onto spiritual teachings that are really going to be beneficial. Sadhamma Savana. Listening to the good Dhamma. So then, in listening to Dhamma in various forms that are appealing and helpful, then that increases faith. With the increasing of quality of faith, that is a support for wise reflection, yoniso manasikara. And three of those, so the Sapurisa Sangseva, association with good people, Sadhamma Savana, listening to good Dhamma, and wise reflection, yoniso manasikara. Those are three of the four supports for stream entry right there. So With a wise reflection being supported, that also supports the quality of mindfulness and full awareness, intuitive wisdom, sati sampajanya. Sati sampajanya is boosted, that makes the mind more fully attuned to the circumstances, and it feeds the quality of full awareness and the sense of what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is beneficial, what is unbeneficial. So it leads to indriya sangvara, or sense restraint, and I feel the best way of describing that is learning to be responsive rather than reactive. So, and that means that when something is attractive, you don't just immediately chase after it or buy it, but you think, oh, that's appealing. Okay, do I really need it? Is that really suitable? Does that belong to somebody else? Can I afford it? Or if something is unattractive or irritating, we don't to react is just to attack it or to criticize it or to blame it or to destroy it, and to relate to painful experiences or perceptions responsively is to say, okay, well, that's unattractive, or that feels really off, or that's unappealing. Do I have to hate it? Do I have to reject it? Do I have to make some kind of snide remark about it, or can I just leave it alone? So indriya sangvara, I feel, is the essence of that, is being responsive rather than reactive. If we develop that indriya sangvara, then that feeds, that supports the three wholesome, the three areas of wholesomeness, wholesomeness in speech, in action, and in thought. That, in turn, is a support for the four foundations of mindfulness: the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensation, mindfulness of mind states, and mindfulness of seeing things in terms of Dhamma, supporting the quality of wisdom, and particularly the insight into uncertainty and change. With the four foundations of mindfulness being supported, that is a support for the development of the seven factors of enlightenment, and that is a direct support. That's the fuel for true knowledge and deliverance and liberation. So that, again, is the same kind of causal chain. Just as the rain falls on the mountains and and it forms into the little pools and streams and larger streams and rivers and fills up the ocean, so that's how knowledge and full knowledge and liberation are filled up. They are made replete. So right at the very root of that is Sapurisa Sangseva. Who do you spend your time with? Who do you choose to be with? What do you choose to put your attention on? So, and I offer these reflections not trying to sort of intimidate people or to make judgments about people's lives and your own choices, but just to encourage us to explore, to reflect, to see how this works, and to see that there's a lot more flexibility in life than we think there is. Often we feel compelled to go along with particular patterns or systems or customs just because we do it, because we do it, because we do it. But there's more space, there's more flexibility in the universe, in our lives, than often we realize. And recognizing where we can make choices and making the effort to make skillful choices, that's in a way where we can really make a difference in our lives. And so if we want to make skillful, wholesome resolutions here on this New Year's Day, to support that, then I strongly encourage us to look at these qualities, the aspect of skillful spiritual friendship, and also how we spend our time, what we put our attention onto, and see the difference that makes. And then that is the best way that we can enable our wholesome, skillful, noble intentions to be fulfilled. So I think I've spoken enough today and offer these reflections, and wish everyone well for this New Year's Day. And hopefully when the vaccine gets circulated more widely and the so-called normal life returns, people can come onto the property, or people can travel and be within 2 meters of each other once again, It's a very unusual sitting here giving a Dhamma talk to a camera and three lay people. There's a number of Sangha members sitting here, but there's only three lay people. Four lay people, excuse me. One was hiding behind, hidden behind the pillar there. So it's these kind of unusual circumstances that we have during this pandemic year will pass on, and that we'll be able to spend time in each other's company physically. And I really hope that we'll be able to open the doors to the deathless realm, to Amaravati once again, and that if not the spring, at least the summertime, we'll be able to welcome you all once more onto the monastery grounds, and to be able to gather together in a more so complete and full delightful way. A1.